This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Jeremiah Jacques, contributing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine, filling in for your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. Well, the United States is winding down the longest war in America's history, and that is the Afghan War, which has been underway for almost 16 years now. The U.S. has spent $500 billion there, and thousands of American soldiers have died, all in an effort to combat terrorism. But now that the U.S. is winding that war down, the world's number one terror-sponsoring nation is rushing in to sculpt Afghanistan in its favor. Trumpet writer Brent Noctegal will tell us how this is happening, why this is such an alarming development, and what the stakes are. And it's really some vital analysis on this topic that Brent is going to present today. In our second segment, we're going to talk about a problem in the United States that you may not have heard that much about, and it is in regard to America's population and demographic trends. What can a country do when the birth rate drops below a level that can replenish the aging population base? This is a question that is suddenly becoming urgent for the United States, and Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has written a powerful article on the proposed solutions, their implications, and some historic parallels. Andrew has some really fascinating information to tell us about this slow-motion demographic crisis. In our third segment today, we're going to go in a different direction and discuss a book. This is a book that is storming its way up to Germany's bestseller list, and the subject matter makes this book's popularity quite significant and alarming. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer will tell us what kinds of ideas this book espouses, and he'll explain just how popular it has become among German readers and what the implications of the growing popularity of those ideas are. And to wrap up the show today, I want to tell you about an activity. You could call this a miracle activity because it promotes total health. That means physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health. This miracle activity is something that you can do with the whole family and with friends too. And one other important detail is that this miracle activity is free. It's an activity that enriches the quality of my life quite a bit, so I hope I can convince you of its value and sell you on it. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Back in October of 2001, following the barbaric September 11th terrorist attacks that happened that year, the United States began the war in Afghanistan. The goal was to defeat al-Qaeda and to deny it an unchallenged base of operations in Afghanistan, partly by ending the Taliban's power in the country. And here we are, almost 16 years on from there, and the Afghan War has been the longest one in all of America's history, and the U.S. has spent $500 billion on the effort and lost thousands of lives, but now America is winding down that war. And without missing a beat, regional adversaries are filling the vacuum and jockeying for influence in Afghanistan. One nation in particular is pushing hard to spread its influence there. To talk about this, we have the Trumpet's Middle East Bureau Chief, Brent Noctegal, joining us from Jerusalem. Hello there, Brent.
Hey, Jeremiah. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So can you tell us which nations in particular are rushing to fill the vacuum that America's leaving in Afghanistan?
Well, you have the resurgence of the Taliban, and the Taliban has been funded and directed by different nations through at different times. Pakistan has probably been the one that's been most forthright with support, and the United States has always tried to limit that by working with Pakistan. But what we're seeing now is an increased push by both the Iranians and the Russians, especially the Iranians, to strengthen the Taliban, providing them with weapons, money, training, even directing some of their attacks against the Afghan forces. And we've seen this come to light over the last year or so, particularly over the past 6 months. And why we're talking about this is the New York Times just ran a massive piece documenting this trend and their piece is entitled "In Afghanistan, U.S. Exits and Iran Comes In." And this is their part two on their Iran series, which the previous one focused on how Iran has taken over Iraq, something that we've talked about for a long, long time. And now looking on the other side of the other border that Iran has with the nation, that being at least to the east, Afghanistan, it looks like they're trying a similar thing over there to strengthen the anti-government force, the Taliban.
So we know that Shia Iran and the Sunni Taliban have traditionally been rivals. Iran even cooperated at first with the U.S. intervention in Afghanistan that drove the Taliban out of power. But now that's changing, apparently. Is there clear evidence that Iran is now supporting the Taliban? And if so, what would Iran's motivation be for this U-turn regarding the Taliban?
Yeah, so there's been pretty clear evidence since probably 2006 that Iran, so for the past decade, that Iran has supported the Taliban to varying degrees in the past decade. Early on, they did support in part the United States action, and that was probably because Iran figured that the United States might actually be a dominant power there to the point that could have changed the status quo in Afghanistan. But as time's gone on and the Taliban has hung around, as Al-Qaeda has hung around as well, and the United States being unwilling to commit the number of troops necessary to defeat those powers, Iran is making the most of its support on the Taliban. Just by an example, you have one province in the western part of Afghanistan that borders on Iran, and both in October of last year and January of this year, there was a Taliban major offensive against the Afghan forces in that province. And the Americans, they had to come in and provide air support for the Afghani army. And then numerous, obviously, Taliban soldiers died in this. But among the Taliban soldiers were four Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders. They died amongst the other four, just to show that they were providing the impetus. And this happened again in January. The United States was called in again to stop this Taliban offensive. Again, Iranian agents were found leading this Taliban offensive. And then you have, most notably, last year, the death of the leader of the Taliban. He was struck. This is Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour. Mm-hmm. He was driving in a taxi in Pakistan, and an American drone hit his taxi, destroying him and the driver. And what came out after, which was told to the press, is that Mansour just came from Iran, where he had a meeting with Iranian and Russian officials, and that Iran was planning on increasing its support for the Taliban, something that even President Obama couldn't stomach. And he authorized, personally, President Obama authorized the strike on this leader of the Taliban, largely because of his leanings towards Iran going to fully Iran trying to become the key backer of the Taliban. Your other second part of your question, what does Iran stand to gain? I would say it's twofold. Firstly, maybe not in order of importance, but definitely important for Iran, is the idea that this Silk Road that's being built across Asia and across the main part of Asia, India's is building a portion of that will travel directly to Afghanistan, bypassing Pakistan. And that way, Iran is trying to join up with that version of it so that if Afghani goods would have to travel then through Iran down to an Iranian port, and the foreign minister of Iran has basically said, hey, you're not a landlocked country anymore, Afghanistan, we're willing to work with you, provide you safe passage of your goods to one of our ports and so on. So they obviously want to ensure that the nation, that the whoever's in power in Afghanistan is friendly towards Iran. The other thing is that by providing weapons, support, cash for the Taliban, they are, and for the Taliban becoming essentially in need of those arms, Iran will find itself with not necessarily a proxy, but definitely a friendly neighbor if the Taliban does take control. And then thirdly, the big one in this is that every time the Taliban strikes the Afghani army, the United States is called in. And it is just weakening the United States a lot to have this Afghan war continue. That is probably, and even the New York Times talks about this, this is death by a thousand cuts on the United States military. Right now, I think they have 6,000 to 8,000 soldiers left there. And this is the hot topic as well with America. What is America going to do in Afghanistan? And Iran loves that. Iran wants to perpetuate that, well, the conditions making them much more difficult for the United States to have an easy way out of Afghanistan.
So Iran is happy to be just sort of contributing to this slow drain on America's economic and military might there. Well, we know that the Islamic State is being squeezed out of its strongholds in Iraq and Syria, and there's some evidence that it's been regrouping partly in Afghanistan. And then we also recently saw earlier this year the Islamic State carried out a terrorist attack on Iran's parliament. So with all of these different factors there, do you think that this somewhat new presence of the Islamic State in Afghanistan has factored into Iran's desire to boost its support of the Taliban in Afghanistan?
Possibly, but I would say that Iran is happy. Iran has used the fight against the Islamic State as a cloak for its own ambition for a long time, or for the past couple of years. We've seen that in Iraq. We've seen that in Syria. And where the Islamic State leaves, Iran tends to control that space, be it in Iraq or Syria. So, yes, we did have the Islamic State looking like they've got a bit of a presence inside Afghanistan, but they're likely not going to grow because they have the rival Sunni extremist Islamist group there already. That is the Taliban. The Taliban, they are a religious organization by nature. They are an Islamist militant group, Sunni. So they're not going, it's doubtful that as Islamic State shrinks, it's not going to have the appeal that it once did for other fighters to leave their Sunni extremist groups and join Islamic State.
So over the past 15 years or so, the U.S. has taken out two of Iran's main enemies on its borders, the Taliban government in Afghanistan and then Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Removing Iran's enemies wasn't America's plan, but it looks like Iran is capitalizing on those U.S. actions pretty powerfully. Do you think that those U.S. actions have led to a visible and tangible increase in Iranian power and influence throughout the Middle East?
Well, it's obvious in Iraq that's been the case, but I would say that didn't have to be that way. Even considering the 2007-08 troop surge in Iraq, things were actually going quite well in Iraq after the invasion. There was some nation building going on, regardless if you think that was the right thing to do or not for the United States. It was in there and it was going well. It was the drawdown of forces in Iraq that allowed the Islamic State to grow. And yes, Iran has capitalized on that. So yes, the United States has helped them to get inroads into Iraq. It's different in Afghanistan because the Taliban, while the United States did remove the Taliban government, the Taliban was never defeated. Not like Saddam Hussein was. The Taliban was always in the background, still fighting, supporting Al-Qaeda. And the Taliban itself is what looks to be allying with Iran. But this is a huge issue right now. Mr. Trump has said publicly that we are losing in Iraq and in Afghanistan. He doesn't know what to do. He's got a number of his generals trying to figure out what policy that the United States can have going forward. And there is no easy option for the United States. You leave, and then so much for the thousands of American soldiers that have died, and almost $1 trillion worth of money is spent. And the government is basically the Taliban once again, or the Taliban will take over if the United States leaves. So you can do that, or you can stay there and not be willing to commit the huge amount of troops that would be necessary to finish this war after so many years, 15, 16 years. And so the United States has got no good options here, which I think is really the significant point when looking at this, the Afghan war, as far as biblical prophecy goes.
Hmm. Could you put it in the context briefly of biblical prophecy?
Well, this is taking away from not necessarily the Iranian angle, but there are prophecies about the nations of end time Israel, which the United States does make up one of those. And in the book of Deuteronomy, and talks about how America's strength would be spent in vain. And I can't think of any other war that this could be more apropos than what has taken place in Afghanistan. A lot of blood, a lot of treasure. And if we pull out, if the United States pulls out right now, they're going to hand the country back over to the Taliban. And the Taliban, it seems, may become a proxy of Iran.
Wow. Well, that's some very insightful analysis there. We've been talking with trumpet writer Brent Noctegal about Iran's expanding influence in Afghanistan now that America is winding its war there down. Keep an eye on thetrumpet.com for an article on this topic. You can also listen to the Watch Jerusalem podcast that Brent runs from Jerusalem, where there's sure to be some more insight into this topic. Brent, we really appreciate you keeping us apprised of these developments and helping us to see the significance of it.
No problem.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Well, if you look at America 10 years ago, we were having 69.3 babies for every 1,000 fertile-aged women. That was about 2.12 births per woman in that age bracket. And that was a reasonably good number. It was an adequate birth rate to keep the population from shrinking. But then came the recession in 2008 and 2009, and many people during and after that time started to postpone having babies. So the birth rate took a dive. And now, even after a few years of recovery from that recession, birth rates are still not bouncing back. In 2015, the rate was down to 62.5 births per 1,000 fertile-aged women, which is about 1.84 babies born per woman, and that's worrisome. Any demographer will tell you that a fertility rate below 2, and especially one that far below 2, will shrink the population. Trumpet writer Andrew Miller has written a powerful article about this trend. It's called America's Demographic Crisis, and you can find that article on thetrumpet.com. And Andrew's in the studio today to tell us about this crisis and its implications. Thanks for coming on the show today, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
I love the way you started your article about this. Could you begin maybe with just some details about the argument that some environmentalists have made against having children?
Right. Well, especially for the past 50 years, it's been pretty common to hear about the dangers of overpopulation. And just a new study came out published in The Guardian a couple weeks ago that was basically saying that, hey, if you want to stop global warming, don't have kids or have one fewer children. Mm-hmm. And that's something I even remember, even as like a child just growing up watching cartoons. You had cartoons like Captain Planet that would have like an entire episode on how you shouldn't have more than two children. Because that's a threat to the environment. And now looking back over the past 50 years, though, we've seen that it's actually been most first world Western democracies like Japan and Western Europe, and now even the United States, that have really seemed to have, for that and maybe other reasons, taken that advice to heart. And so you've got the population of all the first world nations even holding steady or even shrinking, while the population of the developing world still continues to explode.
So that's that environmental argument is probably dates back to the Malthusian view, Thomas Malthus back in the late 1700s, who believed that human populations would soon outgrow potential food supplies and lead to a catastrophe and population collapse. So so he and a lot of others after him have just argued that people need to stop having babies to save the world. But now what we have is these developed nations taking that to heart, apparently to a degree that is shrinking their populations beyond the point of sustainability.
Right, because Thomas Malthus and some others really just took it from a standpoint of that, like, the world's resources are limited, and so the population will outgrow them, and then there'll be a great die-off of humans as we outgrow these resources. But they didn't really take a human intellect into account as a resource, and so Thomas Malthus, he keep making these predictions of, like, okay, as soon as we get past this many people, we won't be able to support this. And then the human population blew past those predictions and nothing happened, because at least so far, every prediction of a die-off has never happened, because as soon as we get to there, the human mind invents some new sort of technology that makes farming or resources more efficient. And so, well, they used to say, well, we can't support more than 1 billion people, and now we're up to 7 billion people and still haven't hit the limit yet.
So innovations seem to keep us going. In your article, you mention the role that abortion, the legalization of abortion, has played in reducing the U.S. birth rate. Could you tell us a little about that?
That is definitely one of the big ones. There's been an estimated 60 million babies aborted since the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision in 1973. Calculating how much bigger the population would be without abortion is a little tricky, because it's been pretty well established that people are more likely to have, like, premarital sex or extramarital sex when they know that killing the baby is an option. But the best studies from the 1970s, when abortion was being legalized at a state level, indicated that legalized abortion does reduce population growth by about 10%. And so if the fertility or if the birth rates decreased from 2.5 babies per adult woman in the 1970s to about 1.8 today, roughly half of that decrease can be attributed to legalized abortions.
Wow. So some of the data that I mentioned in the introduction there suggests that the recession of 2008-2009 contributed to the U.S. birth rate slowdown, but really that's only the latest cause, and it's actually been falling for much longer, going back to Roe v. Wade and even before then. Can you tell us a little about what kinds of problems are resulting from America's shrinking population in terms of economy and other things?
Right. Well, right now, I mean, around the world, like I said, Japan and Germany definitely have shrinking populations. America's population actually isn't shrinking yet, but it's mostly due to immigration coming in. And that is, and if the birth rate continues to decline at the rate that demographers predict it's going to, they're even pointing out that you're going to need more immigration if you want to keep population steady. In particular, in America, the big threat is Social Security. Is that Social Security is something to where, I mean, when they started it, the money people paid in, it didn't just go into a black box where they saved it for you to retire. They immediately started giving that out to retirees in as form of a check. And so now the systems, it's basically like a Ponzi scheme where it relies on three new workers to support every old retiree. If the population starts to shrink, it's projected that by 2040, you'll be down to two workers per retiree. And you have to have a pretty high tax rate for two workers to support a retired person.
Wow.
So the thought is that unless you completely reform the Social Security system, the population needs to continue to grow if it's not going to go out, which from the best calculations they've done, they indicated for that to happen, you either need to have the birth rate double, or actually over double, to four children per adult woman instead of 1.8, or you need the legal immigration rate to quadruple up to 4 million immigrants each year. I guess that would actually be a de facto doubling, because right now we put about 1 million legal immigrants every year, and then another 1 million illegals come anyway. But regardless, it would take about, to keep Social Security solvent, it would take about 4 million immigrants each year if the birth rate stays the same and the retirement program isn't reformed at all.
Hmm. So basically they say, if our own citizens are not multiplying, then we need to bring in people from other countries to fill in the gaps there. There's one especially interesting part in your article in which you draw some really compelling parallels between modern America's demographic problems and those of a certain ancient civilization. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Right. Well, yeah, and obviously the ancient civilization would be the Roman Empire. And Rome is an empire that a lot of historians have looked back at and tried to study as just this world-ruling powerhouse that eventually declined and went away. And it is well known that in the Roman Republic, birth rates were very high, sometimes up to like 12. It was pretty common to have like 12 children per family.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time of Caesar Augustus, the birth rates were already declining down fairly low, and they did have some ancient abortion techniques that became popular in Rome, and then homosexuality had become more popular, which is also bad for birth rates.
Mm-hmm.
And other things. So the population actually got low enough that Caesar Augustus, he made a fairly draconian law mandating that everyone between 25 and 60 either be married or engaged.
Wow.
But even that law was only able to kind of temporarily halt the problem. And eventually, as the Roman population began to shrink, they did start bringing in a lot more immigrants in, and Rome became kind of a model that a lot of people look back to as like a melting pot, kind of like the United States is a melting pot, as you brought in immigrants from Mesopotamia and from Britain, but they all got Roman citizenship and kind of all assimilated into Roman culture. Mm-hmm. Up until about the invasion of Attila the Hun. And then you just had these Germanic tribes just running in wide-eyed terror from these Hun horsemen. And it basically overwhelmed Rome's melting pot system to where you had immigrants start coming in faster than Roman society could assimilate them. And so that is kind of one of the main reasons Rome fell, is that it fell in a very similar way to the Soviet Union falling, is that society became balkanized with different ethnic groups of Germanic tribes, more loyal to their own chieftains and their own people than to this idea of Rome. And eventually the Western Roman Empire just broke apart into a Visigoth nation and an Ostrogoth nation and a Heruli nation and a Burgundian nation. And the emperor in Rome ceased to be.
Well, you've mentioned that the U.S. is not alone. And there are some other countries like Japan, for example, who are contending with this same problem. And really it's in a far more advanced level with some of the European nations and with Japan. And some of these countries have put forth some really interesting and kind of unexpected solutions to try to curtail their declining populations. And in South Korea, the government there has dubbed the third Wednesday of every month Family Day, and they encourage couples to use that time together to, boost the population. Russia's population has shrunk dramatically since the fall of the Soviet Union, and back in 2007, the government declared that every September 12th would be the National Day of Conception. So everyone has the day off, and that's exactly 9 months before Russia's National Day, June 12th. So the idea is to have a lot of births on National Day, and anyone who does can win cars and refrigerators and some pretty substantial cash prizes. And then in Germany, they've implemented something called the Parents' Allowance, which means for up to 14 months, both mother and father can apparently receive up to 65% of their salaries while they are out on leave taking care of a new child. So that adds up to quite a lot of money. And then there are similar incentives for procreation found in Spain and Norway, Denmark, and Singapore also has implemented some things like this. Could you foresee a time when America might end up having to try to use some of these kinds of measures?
I haven't seen anything like that yet, but like you said, different nations do have kind of different strategies of dealing with it. Japan is very, or at least so far, has been very opposed to immigration, even though they're the most advanced in far of demographic decline of any Western nation. Birth rate's down to only about 1.4 children per woman, so they're having to try to rely on like automation and robotics to try to fill some of this this workforce gap. As you said, Russia is a big one that's really trying to do this all with domestic population growth. Europe somewhat as well, but Europe and America have really been the two that have kind of turned to immigration as kind of like the big stop fix, with Europe immigrating. Even like Merkel's government, I think some of the officials have admitted that that's one of the reasons they've been more lax on this refugee crisis from the Middle East, mm-hmm. is that they could use the taxpayers. In America, no, we'll see. Up till now, definitely under the Obama administration, that was definitely their preferred fix for this, is to just bring in as many immigrants as possible. Now with the Trump administration trying to really crack down on immigration, they may have to get more creative with other solutions, because I mean, then that is the threat. Not that all immigration's bad. I mean, America has historically been a melting pot culture, but as that example I brought up with Rome earlier, when you start bringing in immigrants faster than they can assimilate into American society, you get a risk of like a balkanization. And already there's parts of California and parts of Texas where there's entire neighborhoods that don't actually even really speak English. They've immigrated in either legally or illegally faster than they can even learn the language spoken in America. And like I said, just kind of hearkening back to that Roman example, as like Sis said, if you do get some of these social security problems that put a huge debt burden on America that weaken the federal government to a point that is definitely a threat in the future, is like similar to the breakup of the Soviet Union or similar to the breakup of the Roman Empire, that you can actually see a breakup of the United States with different ethnic enclaves just kind of going their own way.
Well, this is a really fascinating topic. We've been speaking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller. He's written a powerful article about this demographic trend. It's called America's Demographic Crisis. And you can find that article on thetrumpet.com. That's our website. Andrew, thank you for this powerful article and for bringing us up to speed on this development.
Yep, thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Back in June, a book was published in Germany. It was actually a collection of essays written by the late German historian Rolf Peter Seefferle and published posthumously. These essays were Mr. Seefferle's observations about Germany's political culture, and the title translates to something like The End of Germany. Trumpet writer Richard Palmer has written about this book in conjunction with Josue Michel. Their article discusses the message of this German book, the book's popularity among the German people, and the scandal that has erupted over its publication and its popularity. The article is up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Germany's Shocking New Bestseller, and Richard is in the studio today to talk with us about this. Thanks for being here, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, could you maybe just fill us in on the details of what Mr. Seefferle's book is about?
Okay. Well, one of the main focuses of the book is not to deny World War II or to deny the Holocaust or to say that Adolf Hitler was a great guy, but instead it still kind of tries to redeem Germany's reputation or its position after World War II. So, for example, it attacks the uniqueness of the Holocaust. So he puts a lot into talking about how, yes, okay, the Holocaust was evil, but we shouldn't put it on a pedestal above everything else. He says, well, Germany, or he said Britain, America have all these evil things in their past. But to borrow his metaphor, they just wash off like water from a freshly waxed boot.
Wow.
They just don't stick. And so his position is kind of he's advocating for a lot more pride in Germany's history. So the title, like you said, it alludes to this, I think, Latin phrase, Finis Germania, referring to the end of Germany. And the idea is that Germans are afraid of their past and they just want Germany to basically cease to exist. And this is the subconscious desire behind Germany's position in Europe. They're just trying to immerse themselves in Europe so that they can be Europeans and not Germans. It's the desire behind the migrant crisis to kind of invite all of these people in from other cultures, from other religions, to kind of swamp and diminish German culture. And he's really making this passionate call that if we want to avoid the end of Germany, we need to return to pride in Germany's history. We're just as much a part of Western civilization and the proud heritage of Western civilization as Britain and America are. Britain and America have done every bit as evil things as Germany has. We kind of had this bad period for about 6 years, in the mid-1930s, 1940s. But we don't need to let that color our whole past, and instead we need to be proud Germans again. Obviously that's not my message, but that's the gist of what he's saying. And so the most controversial ways he puts this is to say that the Germans are the new Jews. So he says that the Jews were unfairly scapegoated as a race for their crimes that some of their ancestors committed in crucifying Christ. And he says, well, in exactly the same way, we Germans are the new Jews, that we're being unfairly held collectively responsible for the Holocaust, for the crimes of our ancestors, and we're being persecuted for that, and we shouldn't be. So it's a forceful call for Germany to be proud of its history and to stand up for itself. And it's a collection of essays, so they're all kind of ones on a similar theme, making some different points. But that's the general gist that a lot of people are getting from this writing.
So he's basically saying the Holocaust was not any more evil necessarily than the U.S.'s massacre of Native American populations when it moved in, and of the it's not much more evil really than the British Empire's colonization of various nations. Therefore, also since so much time has passed, this is right now we're several generations away from the Holocaust, or at least a couple, so it's time for us to move on and to shed this post-war guilt.
That's exactly it. And then this desire to paint what went on in World War II as just kind of a unique aberration from German history, and then to talk about German other history, to go back to Germany's thinkers from, the 19th century, and its artists, its composers, and to recognize that Germany made a huge contribution to Western civilization, and that we should focus on and celebrate that.
Yeah, Mr. Seferla actually says that Germany's post-war culture of Holocaust memory has kind of taken on the traits of a religion in some ways. He says that it makes Germany's wartime sins, mostly the Holocaust, it sort of means that they're viewed as unique, as you said, and absolute in a way that he thinks is unfair. He says it's unfair that the Holocaust is sort of viewed as meaning that Germany is beyond redemption and beyond, has committed these crimes that are beyond comparison. What are your thoughts about his idea that that's become kind of a religion for the modern Germans?
Yeah, it is an interesting point. I think, one of the things we did in this article is kind of compare some of the things that Seferla was saying to some of the things that Nicholas Frank said when we had him over at Edstone, and he was talking about his thoughts on Germany. And one of the kind of points that he made was that Germany kind of very publicly holds up its memorial of the Holocaust, and that it actually allows people to get away with not having a more of a deeper look at their family's personal responsibility what went on, if you like. The kind of the collective memorial of the Holocaust replaces individual soul searching. And so that it's a way of masking a lack of repentance. And he talked about how Germans hadn't, that there wasn't really a look into personal responsibility, but by the whole nation making these memorials, it's a way for Germans to pat themselves on the back and say, we've moved on. So he has a very different take from that. But I think, I understand what he's saying when he talks about it being a religion. I mean, he's not saying that people should forget about the Holocaust.
Right.
What he is saying is that we should look at, shrink it down. When you view German history, it stands out as a skyscraper on the horizon, and we should maybe lower it to the size of some of the other buildings. Hmm. I mean, I think this is what makes Seefeld's arguments so dangerous, really, is their reasonableness.
Right. There's a moderate quality to it. He's not saying the Holocaust never happened. He's saying it did happen, but let's move on. It wasn't as catastrophic as it's been made out to be. So it's easy to see why those kinds of ideas espoused in Seefeld's book would be worrisome and even alarming. How did the German public receive this book?
Yeah, really well. It once it was kind of brought to the public's attention, it appeared on the Süddeutschen Zeitung's nonfiction books of the month list, and this kind of brought it to the public's attention. And after that, it just sold like wildfire. The publisher said that at one point they were selling 250 copies an hour.
Wow!
It reached the top of Amazon's German bestsellers list, so right in the number one spot. On Spiegel, it reached the sixth on their list of nonfiction books, and then Spiegel removed it from the list because the mainstream, it's been loved by the German population as a whole, but mainstream publications have generally hated it. In fact, the Süddeutsche Zeitung have not just withdrawn that particular nonfiction book of the month list that it appeared on, but they have stopped publishing their nonfiction book of the list month entirely while they kind of examine how on earth this book appeared on it in the first place. They're kind of so aghast of the role that they played in promoting it that they're just they're withdrawing or reviewing their entire creation of the list.
Wow.
So it's been you've had this diametrically opposite response where it's been loved by a population and loved by a much wider population than, say, just people that support the Alternative for Deutschland or neo-Nazi skinheads. It's far wider than that, which goes back to kind of what some of what we were saying about its apparent moderation compared to, say, Holocaust-denying books or David Irving or some of those ones that are just obviously wrong and extreme.
Right.
It has had a mainstream appeal with people, but not an appeal from the mainstream media.
So what would you say the book's popularity tells us about the political climate in modern Germany?
I think it shows that there's an appetite now to move on from World War II, to move on from those crimes, that people generally agree with this sense that, okay, let's just stop talking about the Holocaust as much and let's talk about other things. I think it also shows a genuine concern about the migrant crisis. And the book is called The End of Germany, and Germany's always had this kind of this fatalism. I mean, you go back to Goethe and some of these other German literary heroes. There's always been this kind of fatalism there, but that's reemerging again. And you can the fact that a book basically called The End of Germany has resonated so much with so many people shows that people are genuinely concerned about the end of Germany. So it shows that. I think it also shows, and Christopher Caldwell made this point in the New York Times, that you've now got this big widening divide between the elites and just the masses of people in Germany as well. And he wrote that when the German literary establishment unanimously denounced Mr. Seefeld's work as an extremist tract, readers did not nod in agreement. They pulled out their wallets and said, "That must be a book for me." This is a sign that distrust of authority in Germany has reached worrisome levels, possibly even American ones. And that's exactly what we talked about from from the start of the migrant crisis, we said, well, look, if the mainstream media just keep ignoring the genuine concerns that a lot of Germans have about just opening the floodgates to migrants, well, they're going to turn to some of these extremist thinkers, some of these thinkers beyond the pale, if they're the only ones that are addressing their legitimate concerns. And that's exactly what you have here. And you've had the entire mainstream media, I think, has blotted its copybook now. They've discredited themselves now in the eyes of a huge number of Germans. And that's something that's taken place since the migrant crisis, just in the last few years. A massive loss of now trust and respect in mainstream opinion or elite opinion.
So there really is legitimate fear among Germans that their current trajectory, embracing multiculturalism and throwing their borders open to migrants, could lead to the decline of the country. I wonder if you could put this in the context of the German federal election coming up next month on September 24th. Longtime Chancellor Angela Merkel has, of course, been one of the main forces allowing all those refugees from the Middle East and North Africa to flood into Germany. Do you think that the popularity of this book and just the increasing number of Germans who are fearful and concerned and even angry about the damage that migrants are doing to their country could mean that Merkel may not be reelected?
I think when that kind of analysis meets the real world of German politics, I think it falls apart somewhat, because once people start looking and thinking, well, actually, if I vote for, say, the Alternative for Deutschland that takes immigration much more seriously and for many Germans probably aligns more closely to their view than it does Angela Merkel, well, they're actually making more likely a left-wing victory, a victory for someone like the Social Democratic Party, possibly even in conjunction with, say, the Greens and the left, that would be even more pro-immigration than Angela Merkel. So actually what you've seen over the last few months has been a collapse in the popularity of the Alternative for Deutschland. So maybe I don't think this is, I think a lot of the people that agree with this book, that like this book, that disagree with Angela Merkel on the migrant crisis and that disagree with the mainstream media will probably end up voting for Angela Merkel. And I think she's tried to court these people without, I mean, we've spoken about this before, but she's kind of spoken out of both sides of her mouth recently on the migrant crisis, saying, well, we've learned lessons. I wouldn't do it the same way on the one hand, while still trying to kind of gain kudos from her. Yes, we can do this. We can let them in on the other. So I think they will end up voting. I don't think it will have too big of an impact on Angela Merkel's election chances. But rather than, say, looking, just getting bogged down on the minutiae of German politics, if you take the longer view, then yes, this is going to influence German politics. Yes, you've got a very large number of Germans that have a quite a different worldview to the elites and to, say, the writers of Spiegel or the Süddeutsche Zeitung. Now, before we go down that route too much, I think it is important to note that German elites are moving in the same direction as well. That they are still, they may not say endorse Seferla, but you look at what Germany's saying about we need to move on from our history when it comes to our role in the world. When you look at, for example, Joachim Gauck a few years ago at the Munich Security Conference saying we need to make sure we're not held back by our history anymore. Just over the last week or so, there was an excellent article in Project Syndicate talking about saying, Germany may finally be escaping from two complexes that have long constrained its strategic thinking. The first is its psycho-historical complex, which forces German leaders to bend over backwards to reassure foreign leaders about their intentions. So he's writing about how Germany is moving on from its history in exactly the way that Seferla is recommending in his book. And you look at, say, other books that are less extreme, like Christopher Clark's book, I think it was Christopher Clark, The Sleepwalkers on World War One, and that was a roaring bestseller in Germany a few years ago. And what that does was kind of completely overturn the consensus within Germany, the modern consensus that Germany was at fault in World War One. And a lot of academics rejected that view, and his book was very influential in doing that, and came over to this view that, while Germany's not at fault in World War One. And that's part of the same worldview as Seferla, that the 1930s, 1940s are an exception, not part of a pattern of right. German history. And there's a lot of problems with his book. I wrote an article debunking a whole load of what he wrote. Hmm. But you can see where the mainstream are going in the same direction. Seferla is just a bit further ahead of the mainstream. And yes. you've got this groundswell of people that are a bit further ahead of the mainstream. So the division, we talk about the mainstream not liking this and the division between the people, and that's all true. But at the same time, the mainstream's moving in Seferla's direction.
So the whole country is actually moving slowly in that direction, just some groups at different paces, I guess. Than
exactly.
Others. Well, that's some very helpful analysis there, Richard. We've been talking with trumpet writer Richard Palmer, who has written an article about this new German book. The article is called Germany's Shocking New Bestseller, and you can find that on thetrumpet.com. Well, Richard, we really appreciate your time today. Thank you for coming in.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
It's time for today's last word.
Did you know that there is a miracle activity that promotes total health? That is physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health. Science has repeatedly shown that this activity improves creativity, it boosts immune function, and it improves memory and general well-being. And it also reduces blood pressure and stress. This miracle activity is something you can do with the whole family and friends too. And this activity will unify the group, and it will give you the opportunity to better understand key aspects of God's perfect character. And the other important detail is that this miracle activity is free. In most cases, it doesn't cost anything, and it often requires little or no travel time. The miracle activity that I'm talking about is taking nature walks. So for the last word today, I'd like to encourage you to see that nature walks can be a character development tool for you and for your family. If you develop an appreciation for the intricacies and the beauty of nature, then you'll be able to see that it has value for purposes of spiritual education. In the Bible, there are no pictures. It's only words. And nature is the perfect complement to that. In nature, there are no words, but an endless array of pictures and of scenery and of sights to behold. And the Bible says that nature and all of its pictures and sights can declare God's glory. Romans 1 verse 20 says we can learn about the character of the invisible God by studying the visible, physical, tangible things that he created. Your regular host, Mr. Joel Hilliker, has written about this topic, and he said, quote, God created the physical realm as a means of leading us toward and preparing us for eternal life in his family. Thus, we exist in a kind of lab, a gigantic classroom packed with specific elements that illuminate spiritual truth and the mind that originated everything, intended to point human beings toward God. Every detail of it ultimately serves this purpose. End quote. So that's a powerful truth, and really we can look at things like the water cycle, the pruning of fruit trees, the birthing cycle of orca whales, the vine and the branches, the concept of sowing and reaping, sheep in a flock, and we can learn deep lessons from all of this. In all of these things in nature, and apparently in most every aspect of nature, we can gain insight into God's character. We can contemplate why the Creator made these aspects of nature the way he did, and we can consider what it reveals about his manner of thinking. Whether we're just going for a jaunt in our backyard or into the depths of some pristine national park, we can find beauty and learn more about the Creator's mind in nature. And one thing that you might consider to make your nature walks contain more character-building lessons is to plan ahead. This is mostly relevant if you're going to be with children. This might be general planning, like let's look today for the creator's love of detail, or his perfectionism, or his limitless power, or let's keep an eye out for his love of patterns and talk about the spiritual parallels to that. Or it might be very specific planning. You might think ahead about an aspect of God's character that you hope to teach the group about. Maybe it's something that you know your family needs to improve in. Maybe, for example, you feel your family could be more industrious. So you would want to acquaint yourself with the Bible passage there in Proverbs 6 about the hard-working ant and how we should be like the ant in that way. Then your planning could include research about ants. How much weight can they lift? And things like that. And then when you're on your walk, find some ants. If you plan ahead before your nature walk, you'll be able to gently nudge the conversation toward those spiritual lessons that we can learn. And that will make your nature walk more educational and something that can just help to draw you closer to God so that you can take on more of His perfect character. One thing that's important to remember is to try to make the walk positive and fun. If the entire walk is you delivering a stern lecture about the perils of laziness with a furrowed brow, then it will detract from what the general mood of these kinds of walks should be, which is enjoyable and just full of reverence for the Creator's awesome creation. So whether it be in the smallest grain of sand or in the largest cluster of galaxies up in the night sky, the living God has revealed Himself to mankind in His creation. And if you take nature walks with that in mind, not only can it build every aspect of your health, but you and your family can learn more about the Creator and can come to take on more of His perfect character. I'm Jeremiah Jacques. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Thank you for listening today. Feel free to send us your thoughts and questions about the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I'd like to thank our guests today, Brent Noctegal, Andrew Miller, and Richard Palmer. And thanks also to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. And I'll leave you with this thought from Hannah Senesh. There are stars whose radiance is visible on Earth, though they have long been extinct. There are people whose brilliance continues to light the world, though they are no longer among the living. These lights are particularly bright when the night is dark. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.